This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in studio with my producer Lee Delapina here in Lexington, Kentucky. And each and every week, I have the privilege to visit with so many of the people that make our sport a success. And yes, as you know, I'm talking about the trainers. Do want to welcome everybody to the program tuning in across North America on Sirius 93, XM Channel 208, and of course, everybody tuning in on our website with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. Don't forget, you can listen to us every time we are on the air through our website, and of course, go back and listen to podcasts of this show and all of our shows by visiting horseracingradio.net. Very special show here tonight. Looking forward to our two guests. In the first half of the program, trainer Patrick Kelly will be with me, and then Robbie Davis in the second half. So stay tuned. Fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be a great ride over the next hour, right up until 7 o'clock Eastern time. And we do begin with the 66-year-old native of Aiken, South Carolina, and the son of late Hall of Fame trainer Tommy Kelly. Patrick Kelly has saddled well over 800 winners to date, and his runners have earned more than $40 million in purses. Pat, welcome to the program.
Great to be on with you.
Yeah, happy to have you here on Trainer Talk tonight. And, you know, often in the world of sports, we'll hear people talk about, well, my dad had a baseball bat or a golf club or a football in my hand from the moment I was born. Is it safe to say that, considering your lineage, that you were born to be in this horse business?
I was trying to figure out when I first got my first shank in hand.
How old do you think you were?
Probably 12, 13, something like that. Because I know that my first job here at Saratoga, the other thing I was trying to figure out, I think this is like my 60th year being in Saratoga, both as a kid and as a working person. And my dad brought me up here as a youngster in the mid-50s, I'm sure, when he started out with Fed Bully and first started coming up here. So it's been a long haul. It's been great to come every year. So but my first job here at Saratoga was pumping the water buckets, because we didn't have any running water in those days. They had the pumps out in front of the barns, and you had to I filled up all the buckets for the grooms while they were doing the stalls, and then kept the hot water boiler full of water.
Wow.
That was my first job, but I got to walking huts pretty quick once I could get licensed. So
well, I can't even imagine.
They say most trainers are just glorified hot walkers anyway. So,
it's funny. I can't even imagine what it must have been like growing up around your dad's operation and being able to learn from him. And, you know, when people describe your dad, they say things like always happy, never seen him without a smile on his face, always had a kind word about someone, and one of the good guys. What does it mean for you to hear those words used to describe your dad?
Well, it's very gratifying, and yeah, he was one of the true gentlemen of our sport. And in his last few years, he was making it up to Saratoga. He just died last year at 93, but he made it up here at 90 or 91 to keep the streak going for all the years. And I'd put him in the golf cart and take a ride, and everywhere we stopped, we'd be there half an hour, because everybody was, you know, all his buddies would talk about this and talk about that and go back to the old days. So it was a great privilege and an honor to be, you know, working for him as a youngster and around him, you know, all our life, and to actually have a really neat horse there at the end with evening attire to finish out, the recent times.
Yeah, you know, when you think back on your experience with your dad, and it sounds like that's a pretty fond memory for you, being able just to be there with him and to be able to stop and talk with everybody and to share those memories. What's the one or two things that your dad taught you, Pat, that you're still incorporating with your operation today?
Number one thing was patience. Patience. Give the horses a chance to mature. Because, as you know, they're all born on different dates and come to hand. Not all of them are precocious two-year-olds. And as a youngster, when I was his assistant in the 70s, we were, Brookmead Stable and John Schiff and David P. Reynolds and great people that, were breeding their own horses. And you just have to give them a chance to develop. And in those days, we didn't have much two-year-old racing on the grass. And a lot of those horses were bred for the turf. So you kind of had to wait till they were three anyway to get them to the grass. But that was the number one thing, patience and give them a chance. And they'll, they'll reward you. We've had good luck over the years keeping horses going at, later stages. And I know I have terrible statistics for first time out, but I usually don't worry about that because we want to have them around for as long as we can.
Well, people will remember your father as being a Hall of Fame trainer. He was inducted in 1993, but he began working around the track as a teenager and learned the game from the bottom up. Was that the same approach he wanted you to take as well?
Oh, sure. Yeah. All my brothers and I, all of us have trained at one time. There's three brothers. And one of my sisters was actually an assistant clocker up here at Saratoga for many years with the old guy Blue that used to drive the ambulance, who was a character. But, we all got to hang around and learn it from the ground up. And his famous story was he ripped his Sunday pants jumping the fence at Pimlico to get his first hot walking job as a kid. And, he grew up like 5 minutes away from Pimlico there in Brighton, Maryland. So, but he did everything. He tells the story of the guys used to sleep up in the hayloft there at Saratoga. He came up here. He was a groom for Louis Fustel and came up as a young man. So that's the way it used to be in the old days. You worked for many years to get to the point where you could get your trainer's license. And I was lucky enough after working for him all through the 70s. I graduated University of Miami in 1970. And the funny thing is I went to Miami so I could work at Hialeah on the weekends.
So there was a method to your madness. It wasn't just for the education.
Oh, yeah. No, well, I tried Boston College. They didn't want me, but Miami took me and it worked out better. So I could work the weekends at Hialeah and help out over at the track. So in the wintertime. So it worked good. So,
did you ever consider doing anything else as you were going through college?
I took an accounting course that I got a D in that I would have had to go to summer school. and I wasn't going to go to summer school. So anyway, I got a pre-law degree, which gave me a good, well-rounded education in business and stuff. And never really tried anything else. Heck, right after I graduated in 70, Pop goes, he was down in Delaware with Lady Duran at the old Delaware Park, and he gave me a call. He says, how quick are you going to get to Delaware? I need some help. You're out of school, right? I said, yeah, we graduated. Okay, well, get you up there as quick as you can. I got a damn speeding ticket in South Carolina trying to get there too fast.
That's great. So was it a situation where your dad encouraged you, your brothers, your sisters, was very encouraging when you talked about being involved in the sport and he wanted you involved in it?
Oh, yeah. No, he gave us all a good chance if we wanted to do it. My oldest sister is a top-notch head nurse down in Miami at St. Francis. And my youngest daughter, Jeannie, or my sister, his daughter, Jeannie, does a lot of TV work. She got into TV, not with the horses, but with fashion and producing news shows and things. So we all sort of did things at the track, but all the boys trained. You probably know Larry. And, of course, my brother Timmy trained for many years, and now he's the clerk of the scales here in New York. So, and my other brother, Danny, was a off and on assistant trainer at Calder when Calder first opened as a summer facility. Pop left some horses down there and he did that. And he's also a policeman there in Miami, Florida. So about ready to retire, I think.
Wow.
So we all had a chance at it and we've gotten lots of winner's pictures.
Talking with trainer Pat Kelly on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Pat, the other thing I found interesting is that it was around 1954, I guess, that your dad had become the new head trainer for the stable of Dan and Ada Rice. And
right, Ada L. Rice, yep.
Yeah, and saw some potential in a young jockey at that time by the name of Bill Hartack, who he kind of took under his wing and bought the contract from a West Virginia-based trainer, if I recall. And Yeah, and I can only imagine you were about six at that time. What was it like growing up around Bill Hartak?
Great guy. Actually, he bought a house just down the street from my dad there in Miami Springs, and where they all, you know, everybody that worked, it was at Hialeah in the winter. Almost everybody had a house in Miami Springs or Hialeah. They're 5 minutes away, and he was a great friend of my dad. And of course, Chick Lang was his agent for many years, Mr. Preakness, and they're all, you know, Baltimore natives from all around Pimlico there. So a great friendship with those guys. And heck, Pop would go down and cook every Friday night. Bill Hartak would have lobster, and Pop would go down and cook it for him.
When did you decide that this is what you wanted to do? You wanted to train horses, and that's all you wanted to do?
Pretty much when I got out of college. I enjoyed my time in school, but I just figured let's go with this. So I jumped right into it in the 70s and was with my dad there. He had a little health issue in the early 70s that kind of took him off the radar there for a little bit, and he bounced back good from it. But he threw a lot of weight over to myself and Danny to cover for him. And in those days, he was known as Turnpike Tom. You know, he was kind of the original D. Wayne kind of guy, where he had outfits all over the place. We'd have an outfit in New York, outfit in Maryland, outfit in Delaware or Monmouth. And Pop used to run back and forth. My other early job was, once I got a driver's license, was I was the driver. You know, one day we saddled a horse at New York and ended up at Monmouth, and then finally got to Delaware that evening. So we were all over the place in one day. So.
Wow.
But it was great. We had tremendous horses through the 70s, and then I went on my own in the 78 and took off from there and haven't looked back.
Well, when I asked you earlier about the things that your dad taught you, you immediately mentioned the word patience, and that's kind of an old school approach to training horses. Pat, do you consider yourself to be old school?
Well, I would think so, yeah. I mean, I don't... And it's funny because I was lucky enough to train for, as I went on my own in the 70s, I had, Charlotte Weber and Dr. John Weber, the Live Oak horses, who was just starting out, and Fox Ridge Farm, which was Peter Schiff, John Schiff's son, and they all bred their own, and they were trying to breed classic horses, you know, to win the Derby and such, and usually that doesn't bode too well for winning many five ace races, you know, as two-year-olds, so... We got into a program and settled into a good program where we, you know, develop. If they were precocious enough, we could get them ready to win first time. But if we didn't, we didn't worry about it. And as I say, there was in those days the grass, a lot of grass pedigrees and things where you knew they had great potential, and you just kind of had to sit on them a little bit so you could get them to be 3-year-olds. And Solar Splendor, as good as he trained on the dirt for the Webbers, was pretty much a turf horse. Yet his brother Sultry Song was, you know, quite a dirt horse, and we tried him on the turf a little bit, but didn't quite work out that well, but that's fine. He did pretty good on the dirt.
So. Yeah, he did just fine. You know, it's interesting because you said you started training in the late 70s, but it didn't take you very long to get your first graded stakes winner. That came, what, the 1978 Withers, right?
Junction.
Yeah.
Sure. Interesting story about Junction. You can go back, when you get a minute, go back to when he was a two-year-old. I'm looking for a rider at the two-year-old races in Belmont. He was by Never Bend, and he was kind of precocious, so that first group we got from the Webbers. And I'm looking for a rider because he's ready to run. I asked Eddie Maple, and Eddie goes, I got a good horse for Woody. I check with Cadero. I got a good horse. Johnny, you got anything? I got one for John. I got a Calumet horse. Anyway, we ended up with Michael Hole, who was riding really good at the time and rode the horse for us in this maiden race. But if you go back and dig this chart up, it was Aladar, Affirm, Believe It, Junction, and I think the fifth one was Darby Creek Road.
Wow.
They were all in the same maiden race, one May or June at Belmont as a two-year-old.
Wow.
I always meant to go back and, like, pull that off somewhere and look at it, but it was the most amazing thing. Everybody had a good one that they were riding. And a year later or 2 years later, it's an amazing maiden race we ran in at Belmont Park. So,
wow.
They sent me some nice horses. Moliolus was in that group, Junction, and and Medieval Man, who turned out to be a real nice stallion there for a while with the Webbers. So, and Negotiator, the one nice filly they sent us was, I think, was the, you know, turned out to be a real nice mare for us. And the next year, we had the Sunny Dame, who was the mother of Sultry Sun, and then gave us all the Sultry horses and the Solar horses. So it was quite a little group to get started with.
Yeah, that's quite a run. And when you were around all of those good horses as a kid that your dad was training, do you think that helped when you finally started getting good horses into your barn when you went out on your own?
Oh, sure, sure. It's always, and good horses, you know, you train them a little different than regular horses. You know, it's all good horses. You want to have them ready for their races, and they'll give you a little extra to show you why they're a good horse. I mean, after all these years, they've hardly ever been two the same, although some of the Fox Ridge gang I've had grandmothers, mothers, and regular generations of all that gang. You know, my dad actually got Mr. Schiff to buy a toll fee from Michael Phipps, and that was a whole tremendous line of pedigree. She's Brood Mare of the Year, and, you know, just tremendous fillies, Risk Averse and Chrissy Cat and Plug Nickel that my dad had came out of that family. So, you know, it was an amazing, you just never know where a good horse is coming from, you know?
Yeah, that's so true. But you've had several good horses, Pat, over your career. And
I've been lucky enough to have been around some really, really good horses. Yeah.
When I ask most trainers the one thing they would like to accomplish that they haven't done yet, the first thing is win the Kentucky Derby. You had a great opportunity in 1982, and you came close, finishing second with a horse by the name of Laser Light breeder Live Oak.
Right. Yeah, we got real close. Got a Del Sol, Laser Light, and reinvested the three bombers that day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that triple would have paid. I'm not sure they even had triples in those days, but... yeah, we gave it a good run. He had won the Remsen, and he was a real good two-year-old, and came apart after the Preakness, had some issues later on. And the funny thing was, I kept waiting to I couldn't wait to get him on the grass because he was by Majestic Light, and the damn, that whole family had given us, you know, some grass horses, but we never did really get him on the grass. Haven't been back. One shot. I thought we had a chance with Gator Dancer for Fox Ridge, who was a really nice two-year-old, and didn't quite. Had some things pop up early in his three-year-old year, and we missed the chance to get back with him. But he actually beat Skip Away in like the Cowden or one of the two-year-old races at Belmont there in the fall, Paturity or something. Still waiting for the Derby, but we took Sultry Song out, won the Hollywood Gold Cup for $1 million, and of course Evening Attire went all over the place with him, and not much luck in the Breeders' Cups with him, but he was quite a horse, a really neat horse.
Yeah, you were really just getting started in 1982 when you went to that Derby. You were only out on your own for, what, 4 or 5 years, I guess?
Three, 4 years,
yeah.
Just started on my own.
Could you ever imagine we'd be sitting here 22 years later and you're saying, boy, I haven't been back since?
Well, it's a quirky game.
Yeah.
You just never know. Look, Art Sherman's my hero. Maybe I could. If he can make it, I can make it.
Pat Kelly here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Pat, of all the outstanding horses that you've been associated with, both with your dad and with your own operation, who are the couple of horses that you're just, for whatever reason, never going to forget?
Well, the two brothers, Solar Splendor and Sultry Song, the two half-brothers that actually won graded races on the day the Weber's son got married in New York. So we were on the sports pages in the New York Times and the social pages. Nobody could come to the track, and we won, I think, one won the Woodward and one won the Man of War or the whatever, one of those big races. And of course, Evening Attire was just a tremendous horse because that was a mare that Pop had sort of saved and gave us a great, you know, horse that Mr. Grant and my dad were able to have so much fun with there at the end. And, you know, and for Fox Ridge, Risk Averse was as nice a grass filly as I've been around. After being around a lot of nice fillies, he won the one of the first Queen Elizabeth there in Kentucky. It was a three-year-old, and we almost, if she'd have got through on the rail in the Breeders' Cup a few weeks later, I think she might have won the Breeders' Cup. She got jammed up down on the rail at number one and just had nowhere to go down the whole stretch when we wheeled her back in Chicago there in the Breeders' Cup. So,
yeah.
And Christy Cat, who was named after Mr. Schiff's daughter from that same family. So it's hard to pick anyone. You know, I had an old guy called Bomfin for Charlotte and John that loved Saratoga. He'd been up here every year for 3 or 4 years in a row at gelding, and you know, that it's just a pleasure and an honor to, you know, to have such nice horses to train.
So back to Evening Attire for a minute. Here's a horse that, as you said, your dad bred in partnership with Joseph and Mary Grant, and a horse that was foaled here in Kentucky. It ran until his, 10-year-old season, I guess.
Set a track record. We were actually hoping to get back to the Breeders' Cup at that new mile and a half when they finally came up with the longer race. He won a couple of those preps they were having that year when they went back and brought the distance race back. And he stretched the tendon right after Saratoga, just coming. We on our way down to Monmouth to run in a race, and we got there, and he had an issue with a tendon, the only real setback he had ever had. He had had a, from 2 to 3, he had an undescended testicle that was removed, and they gelded him. And it's funny because I think Robbie Davis rode him. My brother had him as a 2-year-old. Timmy had him as a youngster.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, if I can remember, I think Robbie Davis rode him the first time and came back and told my dad, and Timmy says, check this horse's behind. He says, I think he's pinching back there. And it turned out he was a ridging, I think, and it turned out he had an undescended testicle that was actually twisted around. So later on in the fall, they kind of gave him the winter off from 2 to 3 and went up there and took care of that. And he came back strong the next year. And I had him. Timmy had retired to go work for Naira at the time. And I had him from 3 on. So, yeah, no, he was fun to train and loved to train and took good care of himself. If he didn't like a track, he didn't run. And if he loved the track, he'd be tugging at the jockey over at the half-mile pole. If you could bet at the half-mile pole, I'd have probably been retired by now. Could have made too much money.
Well, your dad said that after some of his races, he actually went home and cried. He couldn't believe how lucky he was to have a horse like that.
And the funny thing was, he wouldn't come to watch him run. He was like, he got into this thing where when he came, he didn't do good, and when he stayed home, he did good. So he'd be watching on TV that I'd reach out, come on, Pop, you got to come out. No, I'm not coming today.
Was he superstitious?
I think he was a little bit, yeah. Don't ever be eating any peanuts around the race, the barn or anything like that.
How about you? Are you superstitious when you're training?
Not really. You know, I don't, not really, no.
Yeah. I can imagine it had to be special, though, to be involved with training a horse that meant so much to your dad, and to have the entire family behind you, and you're the one at the controls training this horse, and he goes on and wins big races at 10. That had to be pretty special for you.
He was, of all the great horses I've had, I'm going to have to put him number one, I'm sure, because he was just, and loved the track. We'd try to give him vacations, and he'd get sour on the farm after a month. He loved the attention. He was a real ham, you know. People would bring him carrots and peppermints, and I mean, he just loved getting his picture taken, and just tremendous personality.
Pat, there's more to your career than just training horses. You've been involved with several horsemen's organizations for quite some time, and working with injured jockeys and working with different organizations. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I went on the Jimmy Picou got me to run for the old HPBA when I ran in the early 90s, and now we're called the New York Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association. But I've been not the president, but vice president for many years, or on the board since, I guess, 1990. I'm one of the trustees on the New York Backstretch Pension Fund after many years of being on that, which, you know, we have a great program here in New York for the long-term employees that Mr. Schiff from Fox Ridge Farm and Mark Keller got some great people involved that have a great program set up for retirees. And I'm also on the board of the Jockey Injury Compensation Fund here in New York, which is an offshoot of our THA. And the only thing I don't do is the scholarships. Linda Rice does the scholarships through our group, but we fund many, many. I think we're doing $200,000 in scholarships for employees' children this year here, along with all of our medical and dental and mammograms and all the stuff we do for everybody that takes such great care of the horses here. So it's an honor and a pleasure to serve for everybody and try to wear some other hats that keep the business going.
Yeah, I imagine it's very rewarding for you to give back to the sport that's given you so much.
I don't mind it at all, and you know, it's been an honor and a privilege to do all these things. We're in a great position here in New York with all the great programs we have. We're very lucky.
Pat, what other interests do you have outside of horse racing when you do get a chance to get away from the track for a little bit?
I am a golfer and have been. My dad played golf and taught me how to play golf and got me some lessons here when I was a kid up at the old SPAC over here at the Gideon Putnam.
Yep.
And for many years, I carried around the same set of clubs I learned on over there. But I love golf. Of course, I love University of Miami, graduated there, so I follow them. And love the Jets. I'm a Jets guy, Jets and Mets, not a Yankees Giant guy, but that's by design, because I actually sat in the Super Bowl in the end zone and watched the Jets win their one Super Bowl and got it on the bucket list to go back, but they haven't cooperated. So I want to go see another Super Bowl here one of these years for the Jets. But my dad trained for Townsend Martin in those days, who was the group that bought the Jets from Wismer or whoever it was. I actually went to one of the first, before they were even the Jets, they were the Titans, and we went to a game in the old Polo Grounds right after the guys bought them. Sonny Werblin and Townsend Martin and Mr. Hess, the guys from Jersey, from the Monmouth guys, were the ones that bought them. And through that, became great friends with Howard Cosell, Joe Namath. My dad trained a bunch of horses named after Joe Namath when I was with him. He had all kinds of Joe Willie. And of course, none of them are any good. They always, you know how that works.
They never pan out.
They never pan out, but we had a lot of fun. And he became great friends with Joe Hirsch. You know, Joe Namath and Joe Hirsch were great, great friends and would live up the street at the Miami Springs Villas there in Miami Springs. When the football season's over, he'd come and be at the races all the time. So the amazing people we've met in this business, Ralph Wilson, of course, was a great horse owner, owned the Buffalo Bills and just died. So it's amazing. My dad got to be good friends with Jack Klugman when he had Plug Nickel running in the Derby, and he had Jacqueline Klugman, and it paid off for Jack many years later, because he saw me in the turf and field out at the Hollywood Gold Cup, and he says, your horse is training pretty good, and I says, yeah, I think he's going to like it out here. And Sultry Song, when we went out to the Hollywood Gold Cup, and I think he made a little wager on him, and he was like about 20-1. So he had a good day when he won it that day. So,
well, Pat, it's been a great ride for you and for your family, and can't thank you enough for spending a little time here on Trainer Talk tonight to fill us in. And great to hear your story. All the best moving forward, and I'll look forward to seeing you up in New York.
Stop by anytime. We're down in the barn in the back in the corner by Yaddo 23.
All right, we'll be there. Thanks, Pat.
Great. Talk to you soon.
Trainer Pat Kelly here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Just amazing, amazing history. So integrated in our game. Second half of Trainer Talk, Robbie Davis is up next. Stay tuned for that here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Among all North American yearling sales, one sale outperforms them all. The Fasic Tipton Saratoga Sale.
California Road, Wavering Lake, here's the wire, and it's a photo finish that goes to Tonalist.
Midnight Lucky and Rosie Napravnik buy themselves the 16th out. Midnight Lucky, an easy win.
Wildcat Red, Constitution, won a Florida Derby, and Constitution has won!
The Saratoga Sale ranks number one by percent of Grade 1 winners sold, number one by percent of graded stakes winners sold, and number one by percent of stakes winners sold. So make plans now to attend the Fasic Tipton Saratoga Sale August 4th and 5th, and the Fasic Tipton New York Bred Sale with a record number of more than 300 yearlings on August 9th and 10th. The Saratoga Sale and the New York Bred Sale at the Fasic Tipton Sales Pavilion in Saratoga Springs. Where will you be?
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair strips' gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips. Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 32 Grade 1 winners, and their tradition of raising and selling racehorses continues at this year's Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale. Since 2005, Millridge has sold 37 Saratoga yearlings with 70% winners and more than 5% Grade 1 or Grade 2 winners. This year's Millridge consignment offers yearlings by 8 different stallions, proven to breed racehorses: Kitten's Joy, Arch, Tisnow, Quality Road, Harlan's Holiday, Elusive Quality, Broken Vow, and Hard Spun. Millridge, raising and selling racehorses. For more than 3 decades, Denali Stud has been raising and selling some of Kentucky's finest thoroughbreds. Owners Craig and Holly Banderoff have developed a reputation for honesty and integrity while priding themselves on unparalleled customer service and client communication. The Denali approach has led them to the top of the consignor rankings year in and year out, with graduates including Serena Song, Mushka, Uncle Mo, and Animal Kingdom. Situated on 700 acres, Denali Stud's top management team boasts years of experience. For more information, visit DenaliStud.com. Denali Stud, where attention to detail is standard.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to horseracingradio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
Horseracingradio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. A really fun interview with trainer Pat Kelly in the first half of the program, and looking forward to the second half here as well. Mike Penna in studio with my producer Lee Della Pina in Lexington, Kentucky. And the second half of this show, really, really interesting. Don't often get an opportunity to talk with a trainer who has ridden more than 3,400 winners, but that's exactly the scenario we have here with trainer Robbie Davis. He rode nearly 3,400 winners in a highly successful career as a jockey. That was before hanging up his tack in 2002. He is now the father of 3 jockeys, currently in the midst of launching their riding careers. And yes, he's a horse trainer and very much chief cook and bottle washer, as the saying goes. Looking forward to hearing his story here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Robbie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And you told me yesterday that you are not only the trainer, you're the groom, and you're the hot walker. About the only thing you don't do with the horses you train is try to be a jockey anymore, right?
Well, I have to give that up because we got 3 offsprings that are jockeys. And my wife would probably kick me out of the house if I tried to do everything myself.
Well, I can imagine it's quite a challenge now in a completely different situation than what you're used to, trying to not just train them, but being somebody who's just getting started on the training side of things. You're also responsible for hot walking them and grooming them. You really do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, I just love the game much, and I love being with the horses, and we took like a $700 horse and a $500 horse, and, you know, just see what we could do with them and try to learn the ropes a little bit. And training is very difficult. I wish I would have trained for at least a year or two before I rode, because it would have been a whole different ball game, I'm sure.
Yeah, it probably would have given you a little bit of a different perspective too, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's so much that goes involved, you know, with the breaking and the breeding and the mare. And then you got, you know, the groom, the exercise rider, and the trainer, and all, the gate crew, and all the work that's involved. And then, you know, you leg up a rider, you know, that is chewing his gum, looking at his cell phone, and, you know, it's just like not focusing or not listening to what you tell him. And they go out there and kind of forget what you even tell them, and they mess your horse up in a heartbeat. And it's, you can't, you know, once you hand them the reins, it's out of your control. And I'm not saying every rider, but, you know, the riders that want to be professional and pay attention, they, you know, they cannot pay attention enough and put enough hours into the game to learn, because it's just the more they spend their time learning, you know, the better rider they're going to be.
Yeah, I can imagine that as somebody who was very much a dedicated professional to his craft, the way you were when you were riding, that has to be extremely frustrating for you when you do give a leg up to a rider and you can tell right away that they're not focused.
Yeah, and, you know, they kind of look at the odds board, or they look at the last race, or, you know, and they kind of they're late to the paddock, you know, and they're shuffling along, and then they give you a little, you know, a little, got a little chip on their shoulder, you know, and they're just a nonchalant about it. And then I've had them just gallop around there and not even, you know, and the hole open up and not even persevere with the horse. And I just kind of walked into the bathroom and threw up. I was like, what the heck? And I don't ever remember doing that, you know, but you always got to try to give an effort and, you know, or find something else to do.
When did you know you wanted to train?
When I started working with horse quarter horses, I was there all day at the barn and with the trainer, and I was in the evenings I would do the feeding, and you get to see the other side of the horse in the afternoons, late in the evening with feed time, and I really enjoyed that part of it, where, you know, you get to see the other side of the horse, where they're relaxed in the stall, where they're laying down, and, or, you know, and I just enjoyed being around them. And being a jockey for all those years, you know, I, you know, once you hang up your tack, you know, you have to do what you love. And, you know, I tried to go into the excavating business, and, you know, and I didn't know a thing about it, and it was a total disaster. And so I just said, well, you know what, I got to stay with the horses and somehow. And I opened up a little farm, and that's not quite as exciting, watching horses grow and, you know, getting sick and fixing fence. And that's not, you know, and so I just decided, well, once my kids graduated high school, you know, I said, this is what I want to do. I missed riding is what happened. I just missed it terrible. And I had done a knee replacement thinking I was going to go back to riding, and it took really well, but it just isn't as solid and as strong as I wanted it to be. A horse would duck a little bit and I'd just cringe with the pain. And so I started getting on horses in the morning, and that kind of, you know, I got my fix every morning by at least getting on something. And that's when I wanted to start training.
Yeah, and I know you attempted a couple of comebacks. You tried in 2011 and then in 2013, so it's pretty obvious that that fire still burns in you. Is that difficult for you now, saddling horses as opposed to riding them? Do you still want to be out there?
A lot of times I do, and I miss it. And, you know, if I could just say, you know, if somebody came to me, an agent, and said, hey, Rob, you know, I got this horse, and I got a couple stake horses and a couple allowance horses, you know, and I didn't have to earn my keep all the way to the top again and fight my way to the top, I would do it. You know, I'd do it in a heartbeat and be very passionate about it. But to have to go out there and ride, you know, the bottom of the barrel and then work my way up, it just would be, you know, it'd just be way too hard.
Are you still fit enough to just pick it up and jump back in the saddle now?
I'm fit enough, but I probably have one extra roll on me that I'd have to work off. You know, and you know they kind of stick to you a little more once you hit the 50s, I think.
So where did the passion for racing begin for Robbie Davis?
Oh, well, you know, I was a kid, grew up on welfare, and I lived with my uncle, and in a trailer park, and I raced dirt bikes, and every time, you know, a chain would break or a sprocket, a gas, a tire, you know, and then I'd win a little trophy, and it was kind of frustrating, you know, and I was like, well, I got to find something I can do to make some money at this, you know. And so I started with the horse race. I had a friend that worked at a bakery, John Dalkey and Craig Southworth, and they said, man, why don't you try being a jockey, you know. I'm like, well, what the heck's a jockey? I thought, you know, I knew a jockey was on the radio and a jockey on, you know, a jockey box in a car. And I went to the races, and I said, oh, okay, that looks pretty easy. It's all on flat ground, you know, no jumps to fly over, or, you know. You know, they got a, you know, set of reins, they kind of like the handlebars, and a mane hang on to, you know, and two pedals. I said, well, heck, I could do this. And the jockeys make it look so easy when you watch them ride, you know. They're just sitting up there, and there's so much that goes into it. And I just decided that, my uncle, I told him that I was going to be a jockey, and he's like, wow, don't those horses scare you? I said, yeah, they do a little bit, but it's all on flat ground. It isn't like I'm going through the air and jumping or anything. And I said, and besides, one of my friends is a jockey over here that I met, and he's got a, you know, a brand new pickup, a brand new trailer, and a tall blonde. I said, I want to be just like him. And he said, well, he said, if you're going to do this, go where you can make some money. What do you mean? He said, well, go to New York or California, somewhere where you can make some money. If you're going to climb on them, you just well make money. He said, this place will always be here, and you can come back and ride, but get some experience. I said, well, that sounds good. And then 2 weeks later, he got killed. He was 34 years old, and I was completely devastated. And up behind his trailer there was a BLM ground, and there was wild Mustangs. And as a kid, we'd go up there, try to feed them some grass. We could never get close to them. And I went up there on a dirt bike, and we'd chase them, and we could never catch them and get close to them. And they were just wild Mustangs. And so right after the funeral, I was a pallbearer, and I went to the trailer, and they're having some food, and I'm crying my eyes out. I'm just like, now look up at the sky, and I said, all right. I said, you said for me to be a jockey. I said, I want you to show me if I can touch one of those horses over there, I'll be a jockey. And so I took my suit jacket off, and I started walking up to the mountains, and my cousins were going, where are you going, Robbie? So I'm going to touch the horses. And they said, you know we can't touch those horses. I said, I'm going to go touch one. I says, I can touch one. If I touch one, I know that I can be a jockey. And I walked up there into the field, and here come this great big black one, the longest mane. And I just stood there a little bit, and the horse came right up to me and started stomping his feet and snorting. And I just stood there, and I reached my arm out, and he sniffed on my arm and started pawing the ground, and he started blowing and sniffing, and I touched him on the nose. I took a step back, and I looked, and I was surrounded by all these wild Mustangs. And I looked up, hitting the sky, and there was this cloud, a ring of dust, was going right up through the sky. And I said, wow. I looked up, and I said, wow. I said, you really got me there, Uncle Tim. I said, you got me good. And I know he was up there laughing his brains out because those horses had scared the crap out of me. And they took a step back and walked away. And right then I knew I was going to have a good co-pilot. And I was very blessed to be able to go on with the game. And give it my best.
Talking with Robbie Davis here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network, a man who has ridden more than 3,400 winners and then now training horses, a brand new career for him. He's learning about that. But Robbie, when you started riding, could you ever imagine that your career would end up where it did?
No, my dream was, I was leading a quarter horse rider the first year I rode in Idaho, and the fair meets, and I got to meet Gary Stevens and Scott Stevens, and I met the big boys, and I was like so excited. And I had an old El Camino that was I made into a race car, and I had suspended license and 43 tickets, and so I swapped the license plates with my Aunt Bonnie's Volkswagen, and I took off for Arizona on a wing and a prayer, So my dream was to go to New York or California and just win a race, so what my uncle told me to do. And I headed to New York, and I was riding one horse and after about a year and a half and living in a tack room. And I was praying all the way to New York, and I got on this one horse named Comanche Brave. And I sat in a hot box from 10:30 to 2:30 in the afternoon to ride the fifth race, and I pulled 6 pounds. And I got out of the box, and I got on the scale, and the scale was pumping really, really hard. And my heart was pounding, just thumping really hard. And the clerk of scale said, "Hold still." And I held still, and he says, "Hold still, damn it." And I took a breath, and then I looked up, and I seen the needle just bouncing off of 108 or 109. And I was trying to do 108. And he says, "Okay." But my heart was just jumping out of my chest. I don't know if it was nerves or the hot box. And I was riding one horse, and I went through the post parade, and I looked up, and I said, "Well, I made it, Uncle Tim. Here I am." And I looked at the tote board, and I said, "No, God, I've asked you for a lot of things, but I get to ride this one horse in New York, and I'm so happy to be here. And if you could be with me on this one mount." And the horse, I looked at the odds boards, I remember he's like 28 to 1, 30 to 1, and he broke out of there going a mile and an eighth at Belmont. It seemed like forever, because I'm used to these little bull rings, the little half-mile tracks, and the turn was just so wide, big quarter-mile turn. It wasn't even like I hit a turn. I was like, gosh, I was lost out there. I just kept waiting and waiting, and it was a sloppy racetrack, and I was up on the lead, and I turned for home. I says, "Oh, okay," and I just started quarter-horsing this horse home, and he won by like 15 lengths, and I was like, I finally did. I was so excited. I was so happy to win a race in New York, and my dreams had come true. And,
wow.
So I had to regroup and set some new goals, but it was just, it was just amazing to make it to New York and, have all of, and then have a career, at it. It was just like, I was blessed every single day I went out there on the racetrack.
Well, you had so many great moments in your career, and it's a sport that we often hear has the highest highs and the lowest lows. And you had one of those lows, probably your lowest point, in October of 1988 at Belmont, when you were involved with a spill that resulted in the death of fellow jockey Mike Venezia. And Robbie, I know that was extremely difficult on you, and it really devastated you for a long time.
Yeah, it was definitely a turning point. You work your whole life to make it to the top, and and you become a little callous along the way, because the guys take cheap shots at you, and you got to give them back and hold your ground. But I became a very callous person. I was a leading rider, and it was not easy in New York in those days. I mean, I look back now, there was like 10 Hall of Famers on the bench, that I competed with every day, day in and day out. And Mike came off his horse, and I tried to miss him, and it just so happened I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it just I went home and I had a little, my first son, and he was 2 months old, and I'm rocking in a rocking chair, and I just couldn't believe what had happened. It was just like so devastating. And, you know, some of the things you do on the track are, you know, we're playing hardball, you know, we're race riding very tight, you're race riding, you know, and you're putting, you know, guys in tight spots. And I just, you know, I went back to the jocks room to ride the next day, and they had a little ceremony in the winner's circle, and they replayed that race over. And the horse I was riding, his name was Drums in the Night, and it had just hit me. So, over there. Yeah, it just hit me just really, really hard, and I just couldn't go back in the jocks room and look these guys in the eye and just compete at the level I was at that time. It just, I needed a break. And of course, you know, jockeys, you know, they don't have a break. They ride year round. We don't have an off season. And it's just a lot of pressure and a lot of demand and a lot of stress. And it was time. I just took about, you know, I took off till like March. I went to, Bobby Franco called me to come to California, and said, wow, this would be great. I get a ride with McCarron and Shoemaker and Delahousie and Gary Stevens and Pinkai. And I was like, well, let me go see some, I can learn some new tricks out there, you know. And I got out there, and they just opened arms, let me ride for Mandela and you know, Ron Ellis and Charlie Whittingham and Lucas. I was just, and Bobby Franco, I was in high heaven out there, and I absolutely loved it. My wife is from Queens, and she couldn't adapt to the earthquakes and the smog, and we had our rounds, you know, nothing was ever good enough. And, you know, I was leading stakes rider at Del Mar, but I should be in New York. And, you know, it was, and when you're young like that, so I just said, well, I had some marital problems, and I said, well, listen, if I can't, you know, make you happy, I said, I'm just going to move back to Idaho. So I went and got a U-Haul truck and just packed my stuff up and went back to a simple life. And she said, well, she's going to go with me. So we went back to Idaho for about a year, 91, and went back and just kind of regrouped things and patched the marriage up a little bit. And, you know, and it was good for both of us, you know, and just kind of regrouped. And in 92, we moved back to New York.
Talking with Robbie Davis on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And Robbie, I mentioned that you're now the father of three active jockeys, your daughters, Jackie and Katie, and your son, Dylan. Jackie was the first. How did you react when she came to you and said, Dad, I want to be a jockey?
I was floored. I was like, I thought she was joking me. I was just like, what? She said, no, I'm serious. And then she grabbed me by the shirt after I said, no, you got to, come on, be a first grade teacher. I tried everything. I sent her to college, and she dropped out, the whole thing. And she grabbed me by the shirt, and she said, either you're with me or you're not. And I was like, whoa. And Marguerite said, you better jump on that ship because she's going to do it with you or without you. And I said, oh, God, I see that. And I couldn't believe the dedication and the heart that she had, you know, to start riding, because it's a really tough business. And then being a little girl, you know, it's even tougher. And I rode with Julie Crone, and she's as tough as you can get. And Jackie was just the opposite. She was a little dainty, you know, negotiator, and just a little princess and tap shoes and all that and dresses. And, you know, but I've never seen any tough side in her growing up. But she does have it. And she's a little spitfire now. And she kind of paved the way for Dylan and Katie. And they just got into a little bit, and they got the itch, you know. And I never pushed it on them at all when I was, while they were in school. I wanted them to have a childhood and go to school and be in wrestling and cheerleading and have a family life, you know, and just, you know, get a desk job, be safe, you know. And but they're like, no, Dad, we're not having that. You did it, and we're going to do it. And I'm like, oh, gosh. I just, you know, I guess they say, you know, the acorn don't drop far from the tree. So you don't expect your daughters to do what you do. You know, that just was kind of flooring.
Well, fast forward to December 3rd, 2011, and Jackie was part of maybe your most special moment that you've had in your career, because you, as a trainer, saddled your first winner that day with a horse called Sandy in the Sun at Aqueduct. And before the race, you were able to give a leg up to your daughter, Jackie. She was aboard. Boy, I can't even imagine, Robbie, what that was like.
Oh, I never expect to win. You know, you never expect to win. I mean, you go out there and just hope everything goes well. And if you win, it's a big plus, you know, and everybody's having fun. But the horse was doing just super. And he was a little bit green, and I told her, I said, Jackie, now when you turn for home, just hit him left-handed, and he'll take off for you. And he'll, you know, he should be right there. And the first thing she does is she hits him right-handed, and he ducks in behind two horses. And then she had to straighten him out, and she got passed on the outside by half a length, and the horse came back on and won by a nose. I couldn't believe he won it. And Richie Migliore and him and I were great competitors, I mean, through our whole career. I mean, we just banged heads. But he's in the winner's circle, and he goes, I think you won it. And I'm going, what? No way. He says, I do. I think you won it. And then they threw the number up, and I just went completely ballistic. Like, it was just like, I don't know, just like I was flopping around on the track like a fish. I was just like, I was so excited. I was throwing dirt in the air and just like, oh, my God, I could not believe it. I was like, you know, it's a $700 horse that we just, you know, hope that we could do some good with. And he just, you know, he pulled through. And then to have Jackie on it, it was just like, it was just like the first winner in New York again, all over again.
Well, Robbie, believe it or not, only about 2 minutes left. We could spend another hour talking about your career and some of your highlights. I feel like we've just scratched the surface. But in terms of now with you watching your kids ride, sum up what that's like for me when you're sitting there as a parent, knowing the dangers of the sport, knowing everything you've been through. What is that like for you when you have to watch them ride now?
Oh, you know, it's easier when I don't watch, you know. But you do have to watch, and it's just, you know, you hate to press your luck. You know, this is a sport you never want to press your luck or force things to happen. But, you know, we say a lot of prayers and a lot of candles, and we're so very blessed, you know, every day to just be able to get up and go out there. And we always, you know, hope for the best and prepare for the worst. But it's nerve-wracking watching them go around there. I'm yelling at the TV, and I'm running in the bathroom screaming, flushing the toilet, running back out, taking a peek, you know, if they're still up or not. And it's just, you know, it's hard. It's really hard. But, you know, this is what they chose to do, and they know, you know, the consequences, and this is what we do. We're race riders, and they love it, and they love it with a passion, and you have to. You can't do it half scared, you know. You have to do it all the way, 110%.
Well, Robbie, you always have, and you're taking the same approach with your training career. Want to wish you all the best with that, and can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this visit here tonight. You'll have to come back on for a part two, and we'll cover the other half, my friend. Thanks so much.
You bet, Mike.
All right, Robbie Davis. Here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton, Robbie and Pat Kelly, like all of our guests, going to receive a gift from Flair Equine Nasal Strips. You can visit flairstrips.com to learn more. We'll get that out to them. If you missed any portion of the show, a podcast available shortly at horseracingradio.net. Make sure you go back and check it out and listen to us each and every week. You can go back and listen to all of our Trainer Talk shows on horseracingradio.net and on iTunes. My thanks to Pat Kelly and to Robbie Davis here tonight. It's been a lot of fun to hear their stories. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.